Hi, I'm Libby, and I'll be reading you today's Cape Cod Times, dated Friday, April 26th, 2024. We have a nice outlook for the weather for the next few days. Today, the highs will be 53 with plenty of sunshine. Tonight, it gets cold again, down to 38 degrees, but it will be clear. Both Saturday and Sunday, highs will be in the 50s, lows in the 40s, with plenty of sunshine. By special request from a few of our faithful listeners, we now present the lottery numbers. For Thursday's midday drawing of the numbers game, the numbers were 3, 7, 4, and 5. The evening drawing numbers were 1, 7, 7, and 3. For Thursday's mass cash drawing, the numbers were 7, 8, 14, 32, and 34. For Wednesday's drawing of the Powerball, we have numbers 2, 20, 22, 26, 47, and the extra ball of 21. And finally, for the Mega Millions drawing on Tuesday, the numbers were 11, 17, 33, 39, 43, and the extra ball of 14. The lead story on page 1 of today's newspaper is headlined, Culture Clash? Why It Matters That Knockabout Brewery in Mashpee is on Wampanoag Land, by Rachel Devaney of the Cape Cod Times. As a girl, Mattis Strickland loved to run straight from Mashpee Wakeby Pond to the back door of the Flume restaurant to grab wingdings and fries. Grandpa Earl Mills Sr., chicken salad, and a fresh piece of pie crust from her aunt, Jan Hendricks. The Flume was a highlight of my childhood, said Strickland, who was a Mashpee Wampanoag tribal member. It was a place where Native and non-Natives worked alongside each other and had camaraderie. Mills, also known as Chief Flying Eagle, opened the Flume in June 1972 and shuttered its doors in 2004. Since Knockabout Brewing Company opened in 2017 on the property, tensions between Mashpee Wampanoag tribe members and the new owners and customers have risen. The tension arose recently with a full moon fire ceremony event posting for May 23rd by a third party that seemed to mock Native American culture, Strickland said. Knockabout Brewery is located on ancestral Wampanoag land, and it seems like they have a lack of understanding about our indigenous heritage and sacred spaces, said Strickland. Brewery owner Peter Murner reached out to the ceremony's organizer, Justin Gagne of the Saving Light, to cancel the event in early April after seeing comments from members of the Mashpee tribe on a Knockabout Facebook post advertising it. He also deleted the event posting. The last thing we want is to have a negative impact on the community. We are always trying to support our neighbors, said Murner. Spirituality, culture, and money. The Saving Light offers guidance with spiritual awakening and ascension processes, according to a Facebook site. The group also holds drum circles, full moon fire ceremonies, and walk-in temple-style meditations. It was culturally dismissive and perpetuates harmful stereotypes, said Alexander Pocknet, a Mashpee Wampanoag tribe member of the Moonfire Ceremony, especially when they know the legacy of that space. Pocknet criticized the Saving Light for charging $25 for drum and moon ceremonies, especially when alcohol is involved. I feel like it's just dirty, she said. Spirituality, culture, and money, I don't care what your intentions are, I don't think they mix. Strickland said the event underscores the urgent need to combat cultural appropriation. Murner said he didn't give too much thought about the event when it was initially planned. Gagne, he said, holds spiritual healing events throughout Cape Cod and was hoping to use Knockabout's patio for his group's event. Mashpee Wampanoag Tribal Historic Preservation Officer and Mashpee Select Board member David Whedon said Murner called him shortly after the Moonfire ceremony was canceled to apologize. He reaches out anytime there are controversial issues, said Whedon. He tries to do things in a respectful way. Through Facebook Messenger, the Saving Light told the Times the event was canceled on April 2nd. The organization declined to comment further. Tensions since Knockabout opened. Mills built the flume close to Mashpee Wakeby Pond, said Strickland, because the area is sacred to Wampanoag people. For thousands of years, she said, tribal people have frequented the waterways that surround the space and held ceremonies throughout the woods that connect the pond and Mashpee River. Mills built the flume, said Strickland, as a testament to his heritage and connection to Wampanoag land. When Knockabout opened, said Strickland, owners allowed intoxicated customers to frequent the pond's beach, playground, and parking area while carrying alcoholic beverages. Brewery guests, she said, have also taken up town parking spaces without permission. I've never heard of patrons going down there and causing disruption who have been consuming, Murner said. That hasn't been brought to my attention. Mashpee Police Sergeant Ryan Nardone said there have been occasional problems of Knockabout customers wandering through pathways from Knockabout down the hill to the pond's beach. It's few and far between, but it does happen, said Nardone. Much of the surrounding area, said Strickland, has been disrupted by Knockabout expansion. The destruction of trees, the encroachment on sacred spaces, and the transformation of a once serene haven into a bustling site for alcohol consumption reflect a broader pattern of disrespect and exploitation of indigenous lands and traditions, she said. The flume did serve alcohol and had a bar, but guests were contained in the restaurant, Whedon said. When Knockabout initially took over the building, there was some expansion that cleared appropriate trees and other greenery, said Murner. He worked with select board members and Mashpee conservation officials, he said, to carefully expand. There hasn't been any construction since, he said. That work was part of our special permit plan approved by the select board, said Murner. Whedon said that Murner obtained Mills' blessing before he opened Knockabout. Ultimately, we should be happy someone is using the space, said Whedon. If no one uses it, it's going to fall apart. Issues arising long before Knockabout. There has always been some back and forth between Wampanoag tribal members, the town, and with police, said Pocknett. One of the most known incidents occurred on July 29, 1976, when a group of 9 Mashpee Wampanoag men were confronted, beaten, and arrested by 30 police officers dressed in riot gear, she said. The incident was documented in 2016 with a book and a film, both titled The Mashpee Nine, A Story of Cultural Justice. In 1998, David Hendricks, a Mashpee Wampanoag tribal member, was shot dead on Route 130 by Police Sergeant David Mace. At the time, Mace said he shot Hendricks in self-defense. Tribal members said Hendricks was murdered, according to a 1998 Times article. More recently, a tribal member who Pocknett didn't name died at the pond due to a health-related incident. Right away, she said, rumors spread that the tribal member was killed by another tribal member. The town in the past also used to lock the gate to the pond parking lot early in the evening, but in recent years doesn't lock the gate at all, said Nardone. Except, said Pocknett, during Mashpee Wampanoag Powwow Weekend. As soon as our family is in town and we are celebrating, here comes the police, said Pocknett. They could choose to police differently if they want to. Nardone doesn't feel there's tension between police officers and tribal members in modern times. That's not really a thing anymore, said Nardone. The log hasn't reflected a lot of problems down there, at least last summer. The future of Knockabout. Murner acknowledged to the Times that communicating with tribal members more regularly could help ease any tension. I'm more than willing to sit down with the community face-to-face and hear their concerns and make sure we're adjusting things appropriately, said Murner. I am always available. Strickland said the pond is her safe spot, a place Wampanoag people have frequented for thousands of years. I just feel like the ancestors are rolling around in their graves, she said. This was a place for welcoming Native and non-Native people to experience our culture at the flume. How can we get that back? Legacy of Innovation. Guglielmo Marconi Made History from Cape Cod, by Eric Williams of the Cape Cod Times. Years ago, you could stand on a bluff in Wellfleet and yell at England, and no one would get the message. It seemed impossible to quickly communicate with anyone across the mighty Atlantic Ocean through the air. Better go home and write a letter. Then Guglielmo Marconi came along. The ingenious Italian inventor, born in 1874, began dreaming of a way to send messages from transmitter to receiver without the aid of wires, according to the National Park Service. As he experimented and modified his equipment, the transmissions were able to be received from greater distances. "I call him the Steve Jobs of his day," said Bob Fishback, president of the board of directors of the Chatham Marconi Maritime Center. He stayed one step ahead of his competitors at the patent office. With International Marconi Day coming up on April 27th, nearly coinciding with his 150th birthday, we thought we'd take a look at Marconi's legacy and connections to Cape Cod. Folks can also celebrate the life of Guglielmo Marconi at the Chatham Marconi Maritime Center on April 27th. What did Marconi do on Cape Cod? In the early 1900s, Marconi built a station in South Wellfleet, and there was electricity in the air. On January 18, 1903, the first public two-way wireless communication between Europe and America occurred. With elation, communiques from President Theodore Roosevelt and King Edward VII were translated into international Morse code at the South Wellfleet and English stations, respectively, and were broadcast, according to the Cape Cod National Seashore. According to a 2003 Cape Cod Times story, the station included four substantial 210-foot towers jutting out of the barren tundra of the bluff. United States Life-Saving Service patrols were spooked by the large blue sparks that arced off the towers and the noise of the generators that could be heard miles down the beach, according to the story. Wireless telegraphy also allowed ships to communicate while at sea. According to the National Park Service, effective communication resulted in numerous sea rescues, culminating in the Carpathia's wireless-aided rescue of over 700 people from the Titanic in 1912. The Wellfleet station was closed in 1917 by the U.S. Navy to ensure security and news censorship during World War I, according to the seashore. Marconi also built a station in Chatham in 1914, which eventually became home to the largest ship-to-shore radio telegraph station in the United States, according to the Chatham Marconi Maritime Center. Who was Marconi? According to the American Institute of Physics, Guglielmo Marconi was born in Bologna, Italy, on April 25, 1874. He was fascinated with the radio wave work of German physicist Heinrich Hertz, and began working on wireless telegraphy systems. Much of Marconi's early work took place in England, and in 1901 he transmitted the first transatlantic radio signal between Cornwall and Newfoundland, a distance of more than 2,000 miles, according to the American Institute of Physics. He shared the 1909 Nobel Prize in Physics with Carl Ferdinand Braun in recognition of their contributions to the development of wireless telegraphy, according to the Nobel Foundation. Marconi died in Rome on July 20, 1937, according to the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. How is the Chatham Marconi Maritime Center celebrating International Marconi Day? The center's Marconi RCA Wireless Museum will be open from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. on April 27th. Visitors with a driver's license that shows a Cape and Islands address will be admitted free with their groups. Fishback, president of the board of directors of the Chatham Marconi Maritime Center, said cookies and cake will be in attendance and visitors can find out more about Marconi's story and watch the center's affiliated radio association participate in a worldwide International Marconi Day radio event. U.S. economy grows at 1.6% rate in quarter one. By Paul Davidson of USA Today. The economy slowed more than expected in the first quarter as weaker business stockpiling and exports offset solid consumer spending and a flurry of housing construction. The nation's gross domestic product, the value of all goods and services produced in the U.S., expanded at a seasonally adjusted annual rate of 1.6% from January to March, the Commerce Department said Thursday. That's down from robust growth of 4.1% in the second half of last year and the lowest reading since spring 2022. It's also below the 2.5% gain projected by economists in a Bloomberg survey. However, the pullback was caused chiefly by businesses that replenished their inventories more slowly and feeble growth in exports, two volatile categories that don't reflect the economy's fundamental health. Final sales to private domestic purchasers, which excludes those elements as well as government spending, grew a robust 6.1%. That illustrates there is still a lot of positive underlying momentum, economist Paul Ashworth of Capital Economics wrote in a note to clients. Ian Shepherdson, chief economist of Pantheon Macroeconomics, acknowledged that last quarter's slowdown in growth can be traced largely to inventories and exports, but he added that consumption is also starting to wobble. Consumer spending still solid. Consumer spending, which makes up about 70% of economic activity, has underpinned buoyant growth. Consumption grew a solid 2.5% early this year, following a 3.3% gain in the fourth quarter. The rise was driven by an increase in spending on healthcare and financial services. Purchases of goods, including cars and gasoline, declined. Shepherdson said the 2.5% increase in spending was less than the 3% economists expected, and below the recent trend, heralding a sharper drop-off in the months ahead. Americans' ability to open their wallets in recent months surprised some analysts because pandemic-related savings have largely run out, especially for low- and middle-income households. Credit card debt is at record levels while delinquencies are historically high. But employers have added a booming average of 276,000 jobs per month this year. While wage growth has moderated, average pay still rose 4.7% annually in March, the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta's wage tracker said. That's giving many Americans the wherewithal to splurge, especially now that pay increases are outpacing inflation. Shepherdson, however, expects job growth to slow significantly. Housing helps power growth. Housing construction and renovation surged 13.9%, the most in 3 years and the third increase after 9 straight quarterly declines. Many homeowners aren't selling because they don't want to be hit with a much higher new mortgage rate. That's causing a dire shortage of existing homes on the market and prodding builders to put up more single-family houses. Housing construction also has been juiced by the prospect of interest rate cuts this year, which led to a decline in 30-year mortgage rates from about 8% last fall to 6.6% early this year. Recently, however, mortgage rates have topped 7% as resurgent inflation sparked forecasts of fewer rate cuts. Business investment grew 2.9% after rising 3.7% the prior quarter. Outlays for computers, delivery trucks, factory machines, and other equipment rose a modest 2.1% as companies faced higher borrowing costs. Spending on buildings, oil rigs, and other structures dipped 0.1%. However, business stockpiling sputtered. Companies added to their inventories more slowly or drew them down after replenishing briskly the previous quarter, reducing growth by 0.35 percentage points. World Leaders Call for Hostage Release by Michael Collins of USA Today. Dateline, Washington. President Joe Biden and the leaders of 17 other countries called Thursday for the release of hostages held by the Palestinian militant group Hamas. In a joint statement, the leaders said the fate of the hostages and the civilian population in Gaza are protected under international law. We strongly support the ongoing mediation efforts in order to bring our people home, the statement said. We reiterate our call on Hamas to release the hostages and let us end this crisis so that collectively we can focus our efforts on bringing peace and stability to the region. The statement was issued by Biden and the leaders of Argentina, Austria, Brazil, Bulgaria, Canada, Colombia, Denmark, France, Germany, Hungary, Poland, Portugal, Romania, Serbia, Spain, Thailand, and the United Kingdom. The hostages include citizens of each country. More than 130 hostages, including 5 Americans, are still believed to be under Hamas captivity in Gaza, where they have been since the start of Hamas's war with Israel last fall. The war was ignited by the militant group's assault on Israeli communities October 7th that killed almost 1,200 people. More than 100 hostages were released last year. The Biden administration has for months worked to secure a temporary ceasefire between Hamas and Israel that would allow for the release of the remaining hostages, but progress has stalled. Hamas has rejected a deal that's on the table, and negotiations remain deadlocked. In their statement, the world leaders emphasized that the deal would bring an immediate and prolonged ceasefire in Gaza that would facilitate a surge of additional humanitarian assistance to be delivered throughout Gaza. Gazans would be able to return to their homes and their lands with preparations beforehand to ensure shelter and humanitarian provisions, the statement said. A senior administration official, speaking on the condition of anonymity, said releasing the hostages is the roadmap to the end of the crisis. The fate of the deal rests with one guy, Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar, who has refused to accept it, the official said. Hamas released a video Wednesday purporting to show one of the remaining American hostages, 23-year-old Hirsch Goldberg Polan. The short, undated video showed Goldberg Polan missing a lower arm, but otherwise apparently healthy. Also Wednesday, Biden met at the White House with Abigail Eden, a 4-year-old U.S. citizen who was among the first group of hostages Hamas released from Gaza last November during a truce. Israel intensifies strikes on Rafah. Israel striped up airstrikes on Rafah overnight, killing at least 6 Palestinians, medics said Thursday, after saying it would evacuate civilians from the Gaza border city and storm it, despite allies' warnings this could cause mass casualties. In the 7th month of a devastating air and ground war against the Gaza Strip's ruling Islamic group Hamas, Israeli forces also resumed bombarding northern and central areas of the enclave, as well as east of Khan Yunis in the south. Israeli warplanes had hammered the north for a second day on Wednesday, shattering weeks of comparative calm there, and Israel said it was moving forward with plans for an all-out assault on Hamas holdouts in Rafah on the southern border with Egypt. Survey highlights employer needs cost of living by Colin A. Young of the State House News Service. Most Massachusetts small businesses have at least one open job and say it's been at least somewhat difficult to hire to fill those positions, according to the latest edition of a survey that's taken the small business community's temperature regularly the last 4 years. 61% of small business executives polled said their company has at least one open position in Massachusetts. An equal percentage said it's been difficult to fill open jobs, 32% somewhat difficult, 29% very difficult, according to the survey of 1,818 small business leaders conducted between early February and late March by the Mass Inc. polling group. And 37% of companies said it's been difficult, 28% somewhat, and 9% very, to retain their current employees. The top two obstacles to hiring are familiar: the high cost of living and the high cost of housing. Those high costs are putting pressure on wages. The third most common challenge to hiring is applicants seeking higher pay than what's being offered, a press release announcing the poll results said. The Coalition for an Equitable Economy commissioned the poll, with sponsorship from Mass Growth Capital Corporation and Eastern Bank Foundation. The high costs of housing and living in Massachusetts have been top of mind the last 2 years on Beacon Hill, and addressing them is regularly cited by Governor Maura Healey as her top priority. The legislature is expected to consider Healey's $4.1 billion housing bond and policy bill later this spring. And Attorney General Andrea Campbell is keeping pressure on suburbs near MBTA service to comply with a 2020 law meant to spur badly needed housing production. And 2 years after a debate that led to a new surtax on high-income households, faltering tax revenues and a heightened appetite for spending have stoked progressives' frustration about last year's tax cuts. The cost of living in Massachusetts was cited as an obstacle by 67% of companies, 42% a major obstacle, and 25% a minor obstacle, and 65% cited the cost of housing here, 42% major and 23% minor. The survey found potential hires wanting more money than is offered was also mentioned as an obstacle by 65% of companies, 34% a major obstacle, and 31% a minor one. The fourth most significant barrier to hiring and retention cited in the poll was the tax climate in Massachusetts, 29% a major and 28% minor, followed by many workers don't have the basic skills they need to do the job, rounding out the top five. The transportation system making it difficult for potential employees to get to work ranked eighth. Poll sponsors are hosting events to discuss the results, Tuesday in Boston and Thursday in Springfield. Senator Adam Gomez is scheduled to speak at the event in Springfield. Gas prices expected to rise as weather warms up. By Veer Mudambi of the Worcester Telegram and Gazette. Though it feels like spring has just arrived, the summer travel season is right around the corner. As school lets out, drivers will be hitting the road for vacations, family get-togethers, and graduations. And leading into the summer travel, there's one question that's always on people's mind. What will gas prices look like? Prices enter an upward trajectory simply based on demand in the spring and summer, said AAA Northeast spokesperson Mark Schildrop, starting to increase late winter and ramping up in the spring before peaking in mid-June. After this point, they stabilize before lowering in the fall. Based on current projections, Schildrop believes this year that the fuel gouge will not be a price gauge for New England drivers. Prices should stay where they are before rising about 30 to 40 cents in the next couple of months, assuming steady increase in demand with summer driving season, he said. Massachusetts gas prices, as of April 23rd, average $3.54 a gallon, according to the AAA. The national average is $3.67 a gallon. Shieldrop qualified that hard numbers are tricky to come by, as the oil and gas markets are commodity-based, which means prices are determined through anticipation of changes in supply and demand. As a result, the market can be emotional and reactive, said Shieldrop, such as rising in responses to geopolitical tensions in oil-producing countries. Domestic oil production at record high. Though there was initial concern following the drone attacks against Israel by Iran, Shieldrop said he has not seen prices rise due to the news. Part of that, he said, is due to a particularly high domestic inventory in the New England region. If anything, oil prices have been falling, and that helps, he said. Oil is trading below $90 a barrel, which is on the low side and good for drivers, as the price of oil directly impacts the price of gas. We have more in reserve than we had last year, he said, which means there is no danger of a supply crunch in the Northeast driving up prices. Not only that, but demand is actually trending behind numbers from this time last year. Naturally, this will change as the season progresses. However, there's room for demand growth without impacting inventories. This translates to a buffer for increased demand this summer without raising prices. Quick tips to save on gas. This isn't to say you're completely at the mercy of forces outside your control when it comes to lowering your gas expenses. There are still things you can do while driving to maximize fuel economy. Barring a summer scorcher, take a moment to consider if you really need that air conditioning for the whole trip. Air conditioning consumes gas, so try to open the windows first. Also, being a speed demon can add up, so avoid hard acceleration and braking wherever possible, according to Consumer Reports. Once you reach the desired speed, drive evenly. Smooth driving, acceleration, and braking all help conserve fuel. With any luck, this news means that the gas mileage won't take too much of a bite out of your travel budget this summer, whether it's going to see mom for Mother's Day or that long-awaited post-graduation road trip. We've reached the halfway point of our program, and regular listeners are aware that at this stage of our broadcast, we move to the obituaries. Our first obituary is for Susan M. Moran, Dateline Orleans. Susan Moran, née DeRozier of Orleans, passed away on March 29th while under the care of the V&A Hospice of Cape Cod and the staff of Maplewood of Mayflower Place in West Yarmouth. Susan was born and brought up in Chicopee. She was a graduate of Holy Name High School in Chicopee. Susan had a long career as an administrative assistant prior to starting a glass business with her late husband, Glenn Moran. Susan was predeceased by her parents, Albert J. and Alice M. DeRozier of Chicopee, her son, Douglas, and her husband, Glenn. She leaves a stepson and other family members. Susan also leaves behind her older brother, Bert, and his wife, and her younger brother, Jim, and his wife. Per Susan's request, there will be no services. Memorial contributions can be made in Susan's name to the Animal Rescue League of Boston, the Brewster Branch in East Brewster. Barbara Ann O'Neill, Dateline Centerville. Barbara A. O'Neill of Centerville passed on April 22nd. Originally from Boston, she is survived by her sister Patricia and her brother Herbert, nieces and nephews, and 12 grandnieces and grandnephews. Barbara retired as a business teacher and department chair after serving the communities of Meriden, Connecticut, Randolph, and East Bridgewater. Upon her retirement, she worked for the Internal Revenue Service in the Hyannis office. She was a graduate of Matignon High School in Cambridge and earned a bachelor's degree, cum laude, from Salem State University. Barbara continued her education by earning a master's degree from Boston State College and a certificate of advanced graduate study as well as a doctorate from Boston University. On Cape Cod, Barbara was a member of the Boston University Alumni of Cape Cod and the Islands Association, where she served a term as treasurer. She was a member at Old Barnstable Fairgrounds Golf Club since 1994. In addition, Barbara enjoyed traveling as well as her many years of adult tap dancing. Barbara was especially fond of her nieces and nephews and enjoyed her many trips to New York for visits. Visitation may be made at Our Lady of Victory Church in Centerville on Monday, April 29th at 9:45 a.m., which will include viewing and meeting of her family. A Mass of Christian burial will follow at 11 a.m. Directly following the Mass, burial will take place at Cedar Grove Cemetery in Dorchester. Christopher Wrigley O'Brien, Dateline, Plymouth. Christopher Wrigley O'Brien of Plymouth, who lived a life of hard work, mischief, and adventure, died Sunday, April 21st, after battling corticobasal degeneration. He was 82. Chris was born in Boston and raised in Marshfield, the second of Edmund Thomas O'Brien and Anne Allward Wrigley O'Brien's 6 children. Anne knew early that Chris was going to be trouble when on the first day of the first grade, he returned home at lunchtime and announced school was not for him. He did stick with it, though, and graduated from Marshfield High School in 1959 and Boston State Teachers College, now Boston State College, in 1965. Chris met the love of his life in 1962, Pamela Jean Stott of Duxbury. The two were married in 1963 and later moved to Duxbury and had 3 boys, Christopher O'Brien of Ipswich, Kevin O'Brien of Falmouth, and Michael O'Brien of Apex, North Carolina. Chris began a long career in sales when he was hired by Procter & Gamble. In 1973, he began a 34-year orthopedic sales career at HowMedica that was later acquired by Stryker. He and his business partner, Thomas Heron of Ipswich, founded and operated the highly successful HowMedica Boston Orthopedic Distributorship from 1980 to 1997. He retired in 2007. Here is what Chris would want you to know about him. He loved being outside, going on hikes and discovering new places. He climbed mountains, loved ocean views, and doing anything around water. Chris loved reading and always had a book by his side. He loved learning new things, loved history, and exploring the places he read about. Chris loved Boston sports and had season tickets to the Celtics, Red Sox, and New England Patriots. Chris loved golf, and throughout his business career was able to play some of the best courses around the world, including Pinehurst in North Carolina, where he made a hole-in-one on the 3rd hole of course number 6. When Chris and Pam moved to Cape Cod in 1991, He joined the Pocasset Golf Club in Pocasset, where he formed great and lasting friendships. Chris was fiercely loyal to his family and friends and was always there to help well before being asked. He loved being pop-pop to his grandchildren. His favorite pastime was taking the people he loved to show them something they'd never experienced before, to go on an adventure and to make them smile. Most of all, Chris loved making people laugh. He told great stories. He sometimes, but less often, told appropriate jokes, all with wife Pamela by his side and rolling her eyes. He would want to be remembered with a smile, a chuckle, as you shook your head, thinking about something he once told you. Chris is survived by his wife of 63 years, Pamela, of Plymouth, his 5 siblings, his 3 sons, grandchildren, and many other family members. A memorial service for Chris will be held later this spring or early summer. Details are still being finalized. In lieu of flowers, Chris would want you to do something nice for someone in need. Returning to the news, we have an article titled, More Than 3 Million Air Fryers Recalled, by Cecilia Garzella of USA Today. During the COVID-19 pandemic, one kitchen appliance became a sensation, the air fryer. Its popularity skyrocketed after lockdowns forced many people to cook at home in lieu of dining out. However, some consumers have voiced safety concerns that turned out to be warranted. More than 3 million air fryers from various brands have since been recalled due to hazards, a USA Today review of Consumer Product Safety Commission data found. Of 259 air fryer incident reports reviewed by USA Today, about 1/5 involved injuries, resulting in first aid or visits to the emergency room. No deaths were reported. In mid-March, Best Buy recalled more than 250,000 Insignia air fryers and air fryer ovens in North America, after 24 reports of products catching fire, burning, melting, and shattering glass. The recall affected Insignia models bought between November 2021 and November 23. It wasn't the first time Best Buy pulled Insignia air fryers from the shelves. In April 2022, it recalled nearly 700,000 units. Last February, about 2 million Kosori air fryers faced a recall because of faulty wiring and reports of air fryers catching fire, burning, melting, overheating, and smoking. Some consumers reported minor burns and property damage. About 319,000 Empower Brands air fryers were recalled because a plastic connector can break, posing a burn hazard. And about 11,750 Magic Chef and 6,400 Secura devices have been recalled due to potential overheating. Introduced in 2010, air fryers are recent additions to many Americans' home kitchens. The buzzworthy countertop kitchen appliances work much like convection ovens. They use a fan to circulate hot air, replicating deep-fried food with fewer calories and in little time. But electrical malfunctions and poor wiring can pose safety risks. To report an unsafe consumer product, visit saferproducts.gov or call the CPSC's toll-free hotline. The Ask Carolyn column today is headlined, Mom's Boyfriend Literally Takes the Back Seat to Her Daughter. Dear Carolyn, I've been dating my girlfriend for about 2 years now. She's a single mom with a 12-year-old daughter who insists on sitting in the front seat whenever we go anywhere by car. My girlfriend prefers to drive when we go places together, so typically I have to sit in the back. When we discuss this, she says we should probably take turns. Even that feels really strange to me. I feel like I'm her child's little brother, not her mother's boyfriend. She also claims I started this problem because when we first got together, her daughter asked if she could sit in the front, and I said, sure. Little did I know this would be the way it would continue. Do you have a suggestion for how to break this deadlock? Signed, Feeling Humiliated. Dear Feeling Humiliated, saying you have to sit in the back distills the problems to 2 words. You don't have to take orders from a 12-year-old. You don't have to defer to a partner or child or anyone so thoroughly that you disappear. You don't have to let a schoolyard accusation, you started it, go by unhoweled at, even when it comes from a grown woman, especially when. I do have sympathy for how it feels to be in a hole you've spent 2 years digging. The best time to fix an awkward situation is at our first opportunity. Once we let that first one whiz by, each successive chance is notably harder to seize. I think we've all been there at least once. But dude, just speak up. Of course you don't say anything mean, belittling, or insincere, not to anyone, but especially not to a child. And being light but firm tends to be most effective. Alert your girlfriend, too, that you're drawing the line. Secure her agreement to back you. And if you can't, then run for those green and beckoning hills, seriously. Beyond that, though, how you say it matters so much less than the fact of your saying it. Finally, and without flinching. I'll be taking the front seat today, and from now on, adults up front and kids in the back. My fault for letting it go this long. A lack of courage in your convictions is not a good thing for partners to have in common, especially partners who are modeling adulthood for a 12-year-old. Not just you started this problem, but also you should probably take turns. Holy abdication. Hers is more glaring since she's the parent, but your best response to the daughter was, again, in that first moment, 2-ish years ago, "Whoa, nice try, but no." If not the first time, then the second, third, the fourth, or the single digiteth at the outside, either with the full support of the child's mom or with some serious questions about the health of all the relationships involved. Here's a paradox worth learning, in therapy if that helps. Pleaser tendencies please no one. If your plans include still being in this relationship 8 or so weeks from now, then a parenting class, try PEP at pepparent.org, might also help. Help both of you, I mean, assuming there's any way for a non-parent to tell that to a parent, which there pretty much isn't. Help me, help myself, maybe? However you do it, learn to put yourself in the figurative front seat as well. That's life with wine. Nascatucket Bay Vineyard opens its tasting room to the public. By Seth Chitwood of the Cape Cod Times. Dateline Fairhaven. After 6 years hidden on 52 acres off New Boston Road, the Nascatucket Bay Vineyard opened to the public on April 5th. This vineyard is a dream come true for owner Nicholas Christie, who's been making homemade wine for over 20 years with friends and family. "My grandfather started making wine when he came over from Italy, and we drank his wine," Christie said. "So as self-consumption hobbyists, I have a couple of good friends who we continued doing this with over the years, and it became a big interest for me." In 2016, Christie bought the property for his construction business. "It was 52 acres, and there was no reason we needed all of it," he admitted. "But it was a two-family house and two incomes paid, so it was a no-brainer." As they began clearing the land, they came across a trailer truck and two boats. With the help of friends and family, they cleared the land, put in roads, and created a construction yard. As they were clearing, Christie saw the potential for agriculture and decided to try his hand at grape growing. The wines are all named after Frank Sinatra songs. The first year, they planted a third of an acre and were amazed to see 85 pounds of grapes. "We made some wine and pressed it. We literally just threw all the varieties together," he said. "We tried red grapes and two different lights, and we mixed them all together because it was enough to fill one thing. But we pressed it down to like maybe 5 gallons of juice and blended all the reds and whites together. From this first batch of wine came the inspiration for Nascatucket Bay Vineyard." While Christie will admit that he doesn't have plans of producing award-winning wine, he is determined to produce enjoyable and drinkable wine for his customers. The bottles are named after Frank Sinatra songs, such as their "It Was a Very Good Year," a 2021 Marquette Rosé with flavors of pomegranate and red raspberry, and "I've Got You Under My Skin," a 2022 light red field blend with a dry and fruity taste. The Summer Wind is a 2023 Cab Franc Pinot Noir blend with notes of cranberry, raspberry, and chocolate. The white wine collection includes You Make Me Feel So Young, a 2023 Pink Riesling with sweet honeysuckle and pear flavors, and It Had to Be You, a 2023 Chardonnay with vanilla, pineapple, and sugarcane notes. The One for My Baby wine is a 2023 Pinot Grigio with dry, crisp, and bright honey, citrus, and green apple notes. Nascatucket Bay Vineyard also has a limited edition sparkling pear Chardonnay called Fly Me to the Moon that will be available for tastings in the future. What to expect when visiting Nascatucket Bay Vineyard? Thursday through Sunday, the vineyard offers a wine tasting event where customers can sample 5 1-ounce pours of wines they select using a provided card. They also have a wine flight option with 4 2-ounce pours of wines. But the experience of the vineyard goes beyond just the wine. It's also about enjoying the property. There's something about this place that kind of gets me, and I wanted to preserve what it is, added Christie. With this in mind, Nascatucket Bay Vineyard also offers a variety of specialty foods to go with the tasting, including cheeses, crackers, salamis, and more. We're both Italian and we're both foodies. Food is so important, and natural food and wine go hand in hand, Christie said. Visitors can create their own picnic baskets and enjoy their wine in the Adirondack chairs and around the fire pits and a 12-foot custom fireplace. On weekends, there will also be food trucks and live music, adding to the overall experience of the vineyard. According to Marketing and Events Director Angelique Castriano, the vineyard is a true labor of love with a focus on supporting the local community. We have a lot of local artists doing stuff, said Castriano. A lot of the stuff is locally sourced as much as we could. Same thing with the food, too. If I could locally source, I did. On Thursday nights, they'll host a maker session featuring a different local artist every other Thursday starting in June. They'll come in and teach a class after hours, said Castriano. Castriano said they've created enough wine for what they think will get them through the year, with plans to be open until hopefully the end of November or when they run out of wine, inviting everyone to see the magic of farming. If we still have wine at the end of November, then we'll probably stay open until Christmas. So we'll try to take advantage of that because, I mean, this place just lends itself to Christmas all day long. Castriano has been trying to figure out the exact history of the location. The barn has probably been here for like 100 years or so, she said. I'm still trying to hunt down the original owners or a descendant of the original owners to get more information on that because I want photographs. I want more information. I know a dairy farm was first, and then after that, it was the horse stable. For Christie, he is committed to being a good steward of the land, using all natural methods for farming, such as using fish emulsion and avoiding herbicides. To me, it's like magic growing stuff. When I grow a garden, I watch my grandfather tend his garden, everything that came out of it. It's like magic, he said, adding that he will also offer tours to the guests. There's something about this place, and I want to share that. Author of Little Monsters and Wild Game, Set to Visit Cape Cod, by Frankie Rowley of the Cape Cod Times. The Gardner family may be fictional, but like any family, it certainly has its fair share of secrets, conflicts, and disagreements. After losing their mother at a young age and being raised by their father, Adam, an esteemed oceanographer who struggles with bipolar disorder, Ken and Abby grew up relying on each other, something that hasn't changed as the years have gone by. Now, as their father's 70th birthday approaches, the Gardner family prepares to dish out more than just cake, each gearing up to reveal secrets of their own and figure out how an unexpected guest earned an invite to the party. Almost a year after its initial release and after receiving reviews from the New York Times, Boston Globe, and the Washington Post, to name a few, Adrienne Brodeur's Little Monsters returns to shelves in a new edition as a paperback and with a new jacket. Set on the Cape in 2016, before the now infamous election, Little Monsters examines the relationship between members of a complicated family and how each of their hidden wounds impacts how they interact with loved ones. Brodeur said she began working on the now national bestseller in 2020. Spending a lot of time formulating the plot, characters, and story during her walks on the beach. In particular, she noted being drawn to sibling dynamics, the social climate of 2016, and her background question. As I write, I tend to have a sort of background question that informs the book without it being that subject, she explained. I was thinking a lot about why women have a harder time finding their voice and holding on to power than men do. Excited about writing a fictional family after penning her memoir, Wild Game, a look at her recollection of conspiring with her mother to hide her affair, Brodeur created the Gardner family, Adam, Ken, and Abby. We meet Adam, the head of the house, as he's staring, aging, head-on. Eager to make one last breakthrough by his birthday, Adam stops taking his bipolar medication, unbeknownst to his children. His secret is one of the many uncovered throughout the celebration. I wanted to shine the spotlight on a real family so that we could see the deeper truth inside each of them, and do it compassionately because some of the characters are really wounded, she said. With a house in Orleans and family scattered around the Cape, it was no surprise that the Gardners became one of the many famous fictional families of the Cape. I was particularly interested in each character coming from a different town, because Cape Cod is not just one place, she said. P-Town is as different from Chatham or Mashpee as Las Vegas is from Boston or Savannah. Every town feels so unique. In the year since the hardcover's release, Brodeur said she's received a lot of feedback, especially for her depiction of someone with bipolar disorder, and has had fruitful conversations with readers, ones she's eagerly awaiting to restart on her paperback book tour. One of the unexpected joys of writing is you spend so much time alone in a room talking to yourself, feeling a little crazy. So when you go out into the world with a book and have these conversations with people, it's really quite amazing, she said. Brodeur returns to the Cape with a pre-release signing at the Brewster Bookstore on Main Street on May 4th. When asked about what she's looking forward to about the Cape release, she said she's excited to see friends, fellow authors, and a bookstore she loves. It's the Brewster Bookstore. It's a place I've been buying books forever, she said. It's always delightful. East End Books also hosts Brodeur for a conversation with Cynthia Newberry Martin on August 1st. And she will be at the Nantucket Book Festival on August 13th. For more information about these events and about Brodeur, go to her website. The paperback edition of Little Monsters comes out on May 7th and costs $18.99. To pre-order a copy, please visit the website of Simon & Schuster. Me up. Press Ahead Coffee is the Cape's newest coffee spot on wheels, by Frankie Rowley of the Cape Cod Times. After April 27th, if you spot a blue 1977 Volkswagen bus chugging down Route 6 or Route 28, chances are it's the Press Ahead Coffee van heading to its location or event for the day. Adoringly named Mrs. Potts, the bus is owned and operated by Jim and Denise Pressman, a West Dennis couple embarking on a new caffeinated adventure together. We're just sharing the love of coffee, Denise said. To opening the van, Jim worked in corporate marketing and advertising for 30 years, while Denise ran her own photography studio, Fleeting Moments Photography, in West Dennis, and still does. He said he envied the passion his wife had for her work and wanted to feel the same way about his. I just wanted to do something new, something different, he said. When they began looking for their mobile coffee shop, their first thought was to use a camper, but outfitting the camper proved too costly. By a stroke of luck, Jim saw that the owner of West Shore Coffee in Rhode Island had listed their bus for sale, and he bought it, kick-starting his new coffee career. It was already outfitted as a coffee shop, so we thought we'd be able to pass inspection, Denise said. We bought it and drove it home and decided to make a go of it. Before their coffee van adventure, the Pressmans were at-home coffee makers. Denise said the couple has an espresso machine, but it's nothing special. Through talking with friends and members of the Dennis Chamber of Commerce, which she is a part of through her studio, she learned that the owners of three Finn's coffee roasters, Ron Reddick and Catherine Bieri, helped teach aspiring coffee shop owners the ropes and asked them for some guidance. They've taught us how to use the machine, purchasing the machine through them, and we'll get our beans through them. And the grinders and stuff, she said, it's been a very interesting process. Now, they and their bright blue van are preparing for year-round trips up and down the Cape, serving coffee made from Three Fins coffee beans, tea from Cape and Islands Tea, baked goods from Pelham on the Rise, and merch. We'll have water and all that stuff, so when you go to the beach, you can stop by and pick up your coffee and snacks, Denise said. Press Ahead Coffee officially opens at a ribbon-cutting ceremony at 10 a.m. on April 27th outside Fleeting Moments Photography Studio on Main Street in West Dennis. While the nature of their business is mobile, customers can find Mrs. Potts and the Pressmans at the Chatham Farmers Market, the Mashpee Farmers Market, and outside of Sandy Neck Provisions on Saturday mornings, with more locations being announced on their social media, on Instagram and Facebook. Plus, Press Ahead Coffee is available to hire for events. To keep up with Mrs. Potts and Press Ahead Coffee, follow them on their social media or their website, pressaheadcoffee.com. Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Inductees by Melissa Ruggieri of USA Today. A mix of first-timers and longtime hopefuls made the cut as 2024 inductees into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. The 8 entrants in the performer category span rock, pop, and hip-hop, and were announced during the live broadcast of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Night episode of American Idol on Sunday. The newest Rock Hall inductees are Mary J. Blige, Cher, The Dave Matthews Band, Foreigner, Peter Frampton, Kool & the Gang, Ozzy Osbourne, and A Tribe Called Quest. In addition, the Musical Influence Award will go to a trio of blues heroes, Alexis Corner, John Mayall, and Big Mama Thornton. Jimmy Buffett will be honored posthumously with the Musical Excellence Award, along with MC5, Dionne Warwick, and Norman Whitfield. The annual Ahmet Erdogan Award will go to screenwriter and TV producer Suzanne DePass, who served as executive producer of Showtime at the Apollo from 2002 to 2008. The ceremony to honor the new class will take place October 19th at the Rocket Mortgage Fieldhouse in Cleveland and stream live on Disney Plus and Hulu the next day, with an airing on ABC at a later date. Ticket information for the show is forthcoming. 5 of the inductees landed on the ballot for the first time this year. Cher, Foreigner, Frampton, Kool & the Gang, and Osbourne, who was already inducted as a member of Black Sabbath, which received its coronation in 2006. Blige was previously nominated in 2021. A Tribe Called Quest learned that the third time is the charm, following nods in 2022 and 2023. And Dave Matthews Band, previously the only fan vote winners in 2020 to not land on the final list, won this year's fan vote again, and this time was chosen for entry. The fan vote counts as one vote with the general voting body. In December, Cher told Kelly Clarkson on her talk show that she feels the Rock Hall snubbed her for many years. "You know what? I wouldn't be in it now if they gave me $1 million," she told Clarkson. "I'm never going to change my mind." Other 2024 nominees who weren't chosen for this year's induction include Lenny Kravitz, Mariah Carey, Sade, and Oasis. To be eligible, an individual artist or band must have released its first commercial recording at least 25 years prior to the year of nomination. And that's all I have time for today. This is your reader, Libby, saying thank you for listening.